today's topic is the unionization movement, in particular of progressive companies or organizations. The idea for this was that we are seeing this not just to big companies like Starbucks, but also to small companies that are the kind of companies that we talk about on the podcast and nonprofits. Our guest today is Melissa Weiler Gerber. Melissa is the president and CEO of Access Matters. So, Melissa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
So Melissa is a former lawyer with lengthy experience running nonprofit organizations. Her current organization was recently unionized. So given that much of today's conversation is going to reference the nonprofit space, but in the end and hopefully throughout, we will consider what aspects of your experience may or may not be applicable to for-profit businesses. And I also want to disclose to people who don't know that Melissa and I have a common last name. So we were formerly married, and Melissa is also the neighbor from whom I borrowed whiskey in our prior episode.
My whiskey's always your whiskey.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you being here and doing this. Do you have whiskey today?
You have known me long enough to know that I have a rule about never drinking before a speaking gig. But I'll tell you the whiskey drink that I'm daydreaming about for the future, which is really one that has become kind of a go-to fall winter beverage, which is a sweet potato old fashioned.
Oy, that sounds very you. Do you want to just tell us what that
you'd
is?
I never ask. So, you know, you start with a bourbon that you like. So the one that I would probably go to would be Black Dirt, which is a Hudson Valley bourbon, very nice bourbon. And then you add a little bit of sweet potato syrup, and it's made by this company called El Guapo, which is this woman-owned cool little business in New Orleans that makes syrups and bitters. And so, you know, you take like two parts of a bourbon of your choosing and then a little, maybe like half an ounce of the sweet potato syrup. And it's just got a little bit of sort of warm spice to it, but not pumpkin spice, which I know you and I have a common aversion to. Doesn't get in that territory at all. It's just like a lovely fall beverage, winter beverage.
That sounds awesome. I have the old standby John Gerber House Well Four Roses single barrel.
Can't go wrong with that.
No, it's always in the closet. So hypothetical cheers for when you have yours after the recording. So, Melissa, why don't you give a little background about Access Matters and yourself, and then we will kind of jump into, you know, what your experience has been with unionization at your organization.
Well, you mentioned that I'm a converted attorney, so, you know, it's been a long time since I practiced. But leaving the practice, I then started working in nonprofits in a variety of different leadership roles. And I've been in nonprofit CEO roles for almost 25 years now, largely focused in gender rights and reproductive rights areas. And so I've been leading Access Matters for going on 14 years at this point. And Access Matters is a public health nonprofit that works to ensure that everyone who is seeking reproductive and sexual health care and information can get it. And we do that through a variety of means, both by implementing and coordinating care programs and networks of care, through helping to build the capacity of the reproductive and sexual health care sector through training and evaluation and research and quality management work, and then through advocacy, because you might have noticed that the work we do is under just a tad bit of attack. And so it's always necessary to be engaged in advocacy to protect this work and to protect people's rights. And so we do a lot of that as well.
Awesome. Okay. So clearly a progressive organization, right? So let's talk a little bit about the unionization push and what your experience was or is still at the organization.
Sure. So a section of our staff organized and announced their unionization intentions in December of 2020 at a staff meeting. And, you know, at that point, even though I'm an attorney, I didn't practice labor law. And, you know, the idea was, okay, now what? Part of our staff has announced this intention in the middle of a staff meeting. What do we do? And we, you know, basically calmly as possible in the moment tried to say, okay, you know, we respect that and we're going to need to get back to you because we need to figure out what our responsibilities and obligations are right now. We need to figure out what one does when this happens. And so we talked to our counsel. You know, we needed to think about what this incredibly different legal framework was within which we were going to be working with our staff. We needed to think about communication strategies, because while we hoped that things would go in a good direction, we needed to be prepared if things, you know, went in a different direction and we needed to communicate to the public or to our supporters or to anyone else. And so we needed to think about that angle. We needed to think about thinking about our entire staff slightly differently. So whereas before we could communicate freely across the entire organization about any kinds of issues, we now started needing to think about our staff as both unit staff and management staff. And we had never had this thing called a management team before, but we needed to start thinking about what that looked like and what it meant. And so I think there were just a number of things from the very start where you know, you had to really kind of reset the way you thought about your organization and the structure of it in a very different way.
Okay, so backing up to the beginning for a second. Yeah. So it sounds like this came out of the blue, like you had no expectation that your employees were considering this or feeling like they had a need for a union.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I would say there was some chatter about the possibility of a union probably a year earlier at least. But then COVID happened and, you know, a lot of things changed, things shifted. We organizationally had done a lot of work around really trying to be very, very flexible in terms of use of sick leave and you know, flexible work arrangements during that time period, really trying to be understanding of everything that, you know, all of us were going through at that moment in time. And so we didn't hear very much after that and really weren't sure whether there was still a movement afoot or not. And so I wouldn't say it came as a surprise, but in the particular moment, you know, we had no idea if it was still something that was actively being considered by staff or not.
It sounds like this immediately created sort of this, like, you know, management employee conflict.
I guess what I would say is that I think that when you enter this space, it forces a bit of a demarcation that may not feel like the way your organization felt before, which is not to say in any way that we didn't have a hierarchical structure. You know, we do have a senior management team, a senior leadership team that's an executive team, and other differentiations in our titles and our staff. But we had never before had quite such a bright line between unit staff and everyone else. And that the everyone else category was folks in supervisory positions or anyone in a confidential managerial type of position. We had never had that kind of a grouping before. And we'd never had a structure wherein communications for one half of that group needed to go through a different mechanism and a different body. And so we needed to be much more thoughtful and careful about which kinds of communications were going where and where we needed to go through the representative body that was going to exist through this new union.
Okay. What are we talking about in terms of number of staff and, you know, like how many people are affected by this?
Yeah. So we have about 50 people on our staff and just about half of them are in the bargaining unit. And so, again, that's folks who are not in supervisory positions, not in confidential managerial positions.
So how about like some of the challenges and what the process looked like?
Yeah, I think one of the first things that we needed to decide organizationally and that anyone going through this needs to decide is when you're staff members tell you that they want to unionize, you need to decide if you're going to voluntarily recognize their desire or if you're going to lodge some sort of campaign in opposition to it or something in between. And I think that for us, there really wasn't much of any doubt that we wanted to respect the sentiment that our employees were putting forward, we felt like anything else wouldn't really be representative of our values. We certainly didn't want to launch any kind of opposition campaign to what employees were telling us that they wanted. We did feel as though we had a duty to do some sort of due diligence for our entire staff, because at that point in time, we weren't really certain. We didn't have any visibility into whether any of the folks who would be in unit actually didn't want to have this happen. And so we tried to determine if there was a way, short of opposing and, you know, launching a whole campaign that could be seen or perceived as oppositional, to accomplish that due diligence. And so luckily, we learned of a mechanism called a card count, where you have a neutral third party essentially just read a stack of cards that folks have signed that says, yes, I want to join the unit. We ended up employing a former city council person, a retired city council person, who both parties agreed would be a disinterested and objective person to do it. It happened very quickly. And I think within 2 weeks of our union basically saying that they wanted to come into being, we had voluntarily agreed and accepted and recognized the union, which I think was really the most positive place we could have started that relationship from. And I know the union members have told us that it was very validating and important for that to have happened.
So did that affect the attitude of management in dealing with the union, sort of that initial, like, wow, this is happening, what are we going to do, to a shift to maybe working collaboratively to get to a resolution?
I think definitely it starts from a position where the union knows that at the very least, you are respecting their desire and rights to be able to organize and represent themselves. I don't think it solves the issue that unionization often starts because there's some sort of issue or tension or something that's in the process of being addressed, right? I mean, these things rarely start from absolutely nothing. And I think that's part of the challenge, really, of this time, is balancing those very different emotions that are happening in the moment as something like this is coming about. And I think it's one of the things that can be most challenging in the context of a nonprofit, right? You're in a place where everyone is together working toward a common mission. People are there because of the mission. You like to think that everything is going to go smoothly and that everybody is really singularly united and focused in this way. And yet there are workplaces, like any place else, made up of human beings. You know, the challenge is figuring out how you're going to handle this new thing that has happened, how you're going to leverage this as an opportunity. And part of that, I think, is being honest and introspective about the fact that there is some underlying thing that is at the root of this. Traditionally, unionization often happened around bread and butter issues like wages and benefits and safety. And certainly all of those things came up in our discussions. All of those things were important. And, you know, I'm sure that staff feel like some gains were made in all of those different areas. But I don't think it's what was at the root of unionization in our organization. And I don't think it's what's at the root of a lot of organizing that's happening in progressive and mission-focused organizations right now. I think that's much more about issues that relate to workers feeling like they have a say, feeling like they've got an ability to have predictability and standardization in the way they're managed, in the way that promotions and hiring happen, in basically providing a sense of psychological safety around their workplace experience. And I think it's also around ensuring that there is a memorialized commitment to things like diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives and other kinds of things that are really important to staff. I know in the case of our unionization, a lot of it spurred from an inconsistency in management styles in the organization and folks feeling like you weren't necessarily guaranteed the same experience if you were working in a different department, and wanting to make sure that there was predictability and that leadership across the organization was going to have kind of a standard set of practices that would apply and that would be there regardless of whether players changed over time or people came in and out of the organization. So I think the impetus is a lot different than one might think, or that might have been the case traditionally, and that it's critical that you take on the interrogation of being honest about what's happening in your own workplace. And that can take time for management and leadership to wrap their heads around. It's hard to recognize that some of the things that you might have been trying or working on weren't happening fast enough, weren't kind of meeting the needs of staff at the time. It's not something that you ever want to think that you were part of. You want your place, your organization, your workplace that's doing all this great work in the world to also be a place that feels good to all staff. You know, you have to really, I think, be willing over time to face the shortcomings and think about how that you can improve upon that.
That's part of this that's always been really interesting to me. I've seen it, you know, with your organization. I've seen it with a client. We see it around the city where you have companies that have made employee welfare an important part of their, you know, business. Like, it's a priority. And yet those are the organizations that we see this happening to. From the outside, that just seems like an inconsistency. Like, why would it? I mean, yeah, if it's Starbucks, that's one thing. But, you know, if it's the kind of companies and organizations we're talking about, like, why is that happening?
I think there are a number of things that are at issue there. I mean, one is that I think if you're a progressive organization, you're basically saying, we have a set of values, we have a way that we're going to be in the world. And I think that it sets a very high bar. And I think that it's fair for staff to hold you to that bar. And that's tough because you have already set a high standard. I mean, I think, you know, if you've already put in place wages that are competitive, and you've already tried to be flexible, and you've already tried to do other things that many larger corporations would never think about doing, it's hard to then, for some management especially, I think, to not feel a lot of feelings when unionization happens. When I talk to other leaders who are going through this, whether it's CEOs or executive directors, or whether it's their board chairs, that's often the sense of feelings. It's like a sense of betrayal. It can be anger. It can be all sorts of things, but it's like, how dare this happen here? Like, we're doing all of these things. You know, somebody should go be doing this at a big factory, or, you know, at someplace else where they're not having any control over anything. But I think yeah, it's fair to say that if you're working in progressive space and you say these are our values, that you get held to them. I think that's part of the challenge that's facing the sector as this happens, because I've seen other nonprofits resist voluntary recognition. And I don't know how that is going to leave them in terms of ongoing long-term relationships with staff or clients, because I think at some point you need to square up, what is the action that I'm taking right now? How am I responding to this? And how does it square with the values that we put forward in the world? It's not that you're not going to still feel certain feelings. You're human. And when you're in leadership, some of this can feel very personal. Frankly, it is personal. It is a statement to some degree about something that didn't happen the way that it could have in your organization. And so you have to be willing to face that. And that doesn't always feel good. But I think until and unless you do, you can't really move forward in a positive way in the organization.
This kind of circles back to the process, though, and it does relate to what you just said, because, you know, some of the idea of values and being part of kind of how the organizations run is different than saying we want more money or we need other things, right? I'm sure those things were factors. I know you can't talk about details, but you are dealing with finite resources. There are, I'm sure, trade-offs and things. So you want to, like, give us a little bit on that.
You know, at the start of the process, the union rightfully is going to put forward all of its requests, you know, what its ideal would be. And then it's management's job to really look at that proposal and to think about what it's prepared to do organizationally. And that means thinking about the overall picture for the organization and what's going to work over time. And I think for us, we really wanted to focus in our resources on the things that felt most mission aligned to us. And so thinking about us being a public health organization and thinking about us being really concerned about both community and employee well-being, we really decided to focus in on things like healthcare benefits, things like a more enhanced family leave policy, things like a more enhanced sabbatical policy, things that we hoped would, you know, be very consistent with what we're about in terms of our mission and also would be meaningful to staff. And I think that's proven to be the case.
And so where is it now? You've got a contract. Now what happens?
We negotiated for 2.5 years, and that might seem like a really long time. And a lot of times when I say that to people, they look shocked, but apparently for first year contracts, the average time it takes for your first collective bargaining agreement is between 2 and 3 years. So we were kind of right in that sweet spot at 2.5. And so we ratified, the union ratified, and our board approved the first contract in August of this past year. And so we're now in the first year of implementation. And I will say that the process itself is very, very labor intensive, the negotiating process. You know, we had standing meetings with council every week. We had work in between looking at proposals and you know, editing proposals and making counter proposals. And we had the negotiating sessions themselves. And, you know, the unit members had the same, right? They were doing all of this kind of on top of their regular work as well. And so I feel like when you get to the end of the process and you have this contract, everybody wants to sort of take a deep breath and just breathe again and pause. I can't speak to the union side, but on the management side, there was really no time to waste in terms of getting right into implementation because there are many things, many deadlines, many timetables that you're negotiating throughout the course of the contract that tie back to the ratification date. And so as soon as you hit that date, a number of things start becoming due. And so we had a very lengthy checklist of, you know, all the things that needed to happen over particularly the first like 2 or 3 months post-ratification, you know, things that needed to happen with various internal systems, certain forms or documents or processes that needed to come into play. And a lot of that fell very heavily on our fiscal and HR departments, and especially our HR department. And so that's one thing I would definitely mention is that for folks going through this, the things that you need to think about are the time that it will take when you're going through the process, as well as kind of the time immediately after in terms of setting up processes and thinking about, you know, what's your capacity going to be around that? Is it going to be something where you've got internal capacity? Is it something where you need to add on external capacity to help you through that process? But there's a lot that needs to happen, and it's definitely tied to timetables.
That's a huge amount of work. Sounds expensive also. Like, how do you do that if your company or your organization itself is resource constrained in terms of, you know, people and money?
It's something that is an investment of both time and money. And the time piece, I think, relates to, you know, who is going to be involved in this process, who's going to represent your team as the management team. For us, in making that decision, I felt like the key players would need to be our counsel, our vice president of human resources, and our COO who oversees finances, because this whole process so intimately involves finance and HR issues at every turn, that it seemed like it would be duplicative to have to go through the negotiating sessions with other folks and then bring those folks in. It just made sense to have them at the table from the beginning. But it did create an extraordinary amount of work for them on top of them leading very leanly staffed fiscal and HR departments in the organization. I think that on the cost end, you want to be as effective and efficient as you can. And yet, I think that it would be penny wise, pound foolish to not involve counsel to the degree that you need them. And so whatever you can do to make your process efficient and effective is really critical so that you're sort of pulling in counsel for what you need them and not skimping on that, because I think it just will come back to bite you. But really thinking about how to do that. And of course, that goes back to the idea of what's the kind of tenor that you can set. And for us, that definitely changed and evolved over time. I think both sides went from a state of where emotion was higher to a place where both through gained experience and knowledge in each other, gained trust over the course of the process, just experience and evolution through it, we became more efficient. I think both sides got a better sense of what was most important to the other, which allowed us to come to some collaborative, compromises sooner. But all of that took time. All of that took time to work its way through to get to the other side of it.
Well, I think time and, leadership to actually embrace the process and want to get to that kind of result.
I think a big piece of the evolution was even in my own mindset as the CEO and the person leading our management team. I really needed to think about my own influence and my responsibility in leading these sessions and thinking about where my head was in all of it. And I would really try to ground myself before these sessions and think about how I was going to head into them. And for me, I distinctly remember a change in how all of it felt when I was able to get to a place of looking at what was being proposed or listening to what was being proposed, allowing myself to feel whatever I was going to feel, pausing and approaching with curiosity, really trying to say, whatever this thing is that's being presented, I'm going to ask more about it. I'm going to ask probing questions because there's something behind it that's necessitating this ask. There's something behind it that is a concern or was an incident or was an experience that someone had personally that led to this request. And as soon as I made that switch and really started approaching things in that way and encouraging our entire team to do that, you ask questions. And each time, I think what you discover is that there is, in fact, something there that is concrete and specific and manageable. I think when you don't ask questions, you imagine these things that feel very amorphous and hard to address and hard to resolve. And when you've got some specific examples of, well, this was a thing that happened in this department, or this manager did XYZ and it made the staff person feel a certain way. When you have those examples and you can work with those, you can almost always craft a better solution that is tailored to what the actual concern is behind it. And the more we did that, the more successful we were.
To me, that sounds like the key piece is sort of your mindset, embracing it and having this curious approach, which I like that terminology.
Thinking back about the start of our process, I think some of the biggest challenges were around the learning curves that had to happen on both sides. So a lot of nonprofits, not all, but a lot of nonprofits right now are being represented by unions that are traditional unions that are used to working in the for-profit space. So for instance, our union is working with the News Guild, and the Defenders Association in Philadelphia, I believe, is working with the United Auto Workers. So while there are some unions that are cropping up that are working specifically with nonprofits, that's not always the case. And so I think there was a big learning curve in terms of really understanding the way our finances and budgeting worked versus, say, for instance, an organization that has unrestricted advertising revenue or more discretionary funds. Our funding is almost exclusively government funding, and it's heavily restricted in terms of what it can be used for. We have very, very detailed budgets that go along with all of our grants. And so I think for a time, there was some skepticism around whether we were being really forthcoming about our ability to move money around or operate in a more discretionary way about the amount of funding that we have. And I think over time, there was increased understanding on all sides about how our programs work, how our grants are funded, and that led to greater trust around, you know, what we were putting forward in terms of what we were prepared to do in certain areas with funding. I think it also helped us to think more realistically about what we might be able to do when, for instance, a program comes to an end. A grant ends, and not only does the grant end, but also the work that was attached to that grant ends. So there's no funding to really support a job going forward. How do we create a softer landing? How do we give notice in advance, far enough in advance, if we can't give a soft landing? Like, what does all of that look like to be as fair as possible in the context of the kind of work that we're doing?
I want to talk a little bit about what you're seeing in the market, you know, both for nonprofits and if you have some insight into what's happening in the business community also.
So a lot of folks, when I tell them that our workplace is unionized, are really surprised because we're a nonprofit and they just haven't heard of unionization in the nonprofit space. There are some organizations that have been unionized for a long period of time. I'm thinking about legal services nonprofits, some of which have been unionized for decades. I think, though, that this latest movement of unionization is different and is broader. I think that a lot of it started within the reproductive health space prior to sweeping more broadly across other progressive nonprofits. And I suspect that may be true in part because reproductive and sexual health is so politicized to begin with that I think it attracts a very kind of politicized workforce and workforce that's really engaged in that way. But I think it is broader. And I think that, I mean, I'm certainly seeing it and hearing about it in progressive small business spaces, non-Starbucks coffee shops, but other kinds of, you know, smaller businesses looking to do the same kind of thing. And I suspect, as we talked about before, it's coming from a similar kind of space of feeling like this is an organization that has really professed its dedication to certain kinds of values. And I think when you're in those kinds of spaces, whether it's for-profit or nonprofit, you have in some ways created a safe space for staff to feel like they can come forward with concerns in a way that staff might feel like they don't have the freedom to do in other kinds of workplaces. And so while it may feel antithetical in some ways, I think it's actually pretty consistent that you've opened up a space that allows for dissent and allows for people to step forward without necessarily thinking like, I'm going to get thrown out of this place for doing so. I mean, so it's, I think, consistent with the kind of space you're trying to create. And it's a different mechanism for staff to really speak up and talk to the issues that they care about most and the things that they want to see in the organization. I know that our staff and other unions that I've seen have basically said, like, I'm doing this because I want to stay in this organization. I care about this organization. I want it to thrive. And these are things that we feel need to happen in order for that to occur. So it's a way of demonstrating an investment in the organization long term. Again, it may not feel that way to management when it first happens. I think it probably more often than not doesn't. It's you know, people take it very personally. I can say there are a lot of things that I felt. I mean, there's no way that I could or would want to back away from where I started. But I think you have to figure out how you're going to move past those feelings and see it as an opportunity for growth.
Are there other aspects that you think would apply from the nonprofit to the for-profit context?
I think a lot of the process is very similar, right? Whether you're in a for-profit space or a nonprofit space, the laws that govern this process are the same. The general structure for how it rolls out is going to be exactly the same. The idea of creating a management team that's going to be the lead negotiating team is going to be the same. Where things are going to shift is just a matter of what your funding looks like and what's important to your organization in terms of where you feel like you're going to focus the limited resources that you have. And then I think really figuring out, getting a good sense of what your finances look like and what you're able to commit to over time, being realistic about that. You're now creating a legally binding contract. You want to make sure that you can actually deliver on what you're saying. You know, for a small business, that could be challenging to think about what can I promise that's going to last the 3 to 5 years of an average contract. The other pieces that are very helpful to us that I think would apply across the board is that we now have a very concrete, spelled out mechanism for how certain kinds of questions, issues, discussions, conflicts are going to be handled within the organization. You know, there's a very clear process for bringing those kinds of things forward in a timely way so that they can be addressed. And of course, there's hopefully an improved communication mechanism between a level of your staff that was feeling cut off or not as included in certain things before that, you know, you hope will move forward in a really positive way. And I think on the staff side, some of the positives clearly are around, you know, predictability around things like hiring, you know, promotions, opportunities, workload balance, you know, some enhanced vacation and time off policies, more contributions to benefits and 403b, like a lot of things that I think really give both financial security, but also some security around just the environment, the culture, like the way things are going to run. And I think that's really important also through leadership transitions, right? Like you can have people at different levels moving in and out, but there is a sense of stability and continuity about this framework that you've put forward that really sets forth the philosophy and culture of the organization in a lot of ways. And I think that's a benefit really on both sides for the management team and for employees.
Really interesting. And thank you for all the insights. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to give?
You know, I think that what is really important is that if unionization happens in your workplace, allow yourself a little bit of time to feel whatever it is you're going to feel, because that's real. If you're in a leadership role and staff come to you with this, you probably sense in your gut that something hasn't been quite right. You also now know that you've got something coming up that's going to take an extraordinary amount of time and effort and intellectual discipline and emotion and expense, all those kinds of things are going to be coming up. So it's a big thing for your organization. So feel all the things that you're going to feel. And then try to move past that as quickly as possible and see this as an opportunity. Because again, employees coming to you with this doesn't have to feel oppositional. It may feel that way initially. It may even be presented that way initially, depending on where things are within your organization. But it is, at the end of the day, an opportunity for growth and enhancement. And I will tell you that if you had asked me 2.5 years ago if that's what I would be saying today, I have to be honest and say it wouldn't be. For me, it was a real learning curve, and there was an incredible growth trajectory. But when we got to the end of it in August, and I was able to see true joy and pride coming from both the union side and the management team side on achieving this thing together, this opportunity where I know we have now better aligned our policies and practices with our mission and our values, that was incredibly gratifying and just an amazing experience that I feel really grateful to have been part of. It's worth it. You get there and you have a set of policies that everyone on your team can feel really good about.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Whiskey Fridays podcast. You can learn more about Melissa's work and Access Matters on their website at www.accessmatters.org. And it's Access Matters on all of the social medias.
And if anyone listening has questions about sexual and reproductive health care or needs a referral, you can always call our confidential Access Matters information hotline at 215-985-3300, or you can text the hotline at 833-667-3377.
As always, you can find me, John Gerber, at unlawyer.com. And if this episode resonated with you in any way, we'd love to hear if you shared it with a friend. Thank you, and talk to you next time. Music this week is by Dan Matz.